Hello and welcome to Weekly Monotony, the official podcast of the entertainment blog DailyMonotony.com, the last remaining wretched hive of scum and villainy on the interwebs. You must be cautious. My name is Dustin Anglin.
I am Mr. Scott Johnsgaard, but if you want, you can call me Doctor.
I'm Sean Choate, and I'm not sure about that scum and villainy thing. I think 4chan's still got you beat.
Dang it!
I'm Stephen Duncan, and this is my first appearance on the show.
As it should be,
I suppose.
All right, great. So first off, as always, we're going to go through what we've been watching and what we've been playing for the past week. I will shoot things off to my co-editor and co-creator of the site, DailyMonotony.com, Mr. Scott Johnsgaard.
That's Dr.
Scott Johnsgaard.
Thank you. Well, of course, everybody who thinks they're smart but isn't actually smart likes what Fox offers up on Monday, which is the Vicodin Sputtered Adventures of Dr. Gregory House. So I'm pretty sure that everyone who is anyone is watching that show. For the people who are smart and think they're smart, there's ABC's offering on Wednesdays Lost, which just opened this past week after a long hiatus. And I still hate the show and watch it anyway.
Wait, do we still hate Lost or House?
Well, both, but Lost more than House.
Blasphemy! That's another show.
Yes, it is. Weekly Blasphemy is another website.
Great, anything you've been playing this week?
If I said Rock Band 2 exclusively, would you look down on me?
I don't think that counts anymore. I think you can use that once, but... All right, let's move on. Sean, what have you been watching? What have you been playing?
Haven't been watching much. Have been playing, well, Rock Band 2. Have also been playing a goodly amount of various games on Kongregate, most especially Super Energy Apocalypse, but a few others as well.
Right, and to all those listening to the show, Super Energy Apocalypse is made by a friend of the show, Lars Doucet. It just came out on Kongregate. You should go and play it. It's an awesome, awesome real-time strategy energy consumption game. Highly recommend it.
We say Super Energy Apocalypse. We've got a new version. It's called Super Energy Apocalypse Recycled, and that's the one you want to play.
And, of course, in the entrance...
Yes.
For full disclosure purposes, we must say that Daily Monotony and Weekly Monotony contributor Sean Choate is, in fact, a member of Brain Juice Games Limited Liability Corporation, which owns and controls the rights to Super Energy Apocalypse.
Exactly.
It's true. And very happy to be that.
Great. Well, newcomer, Stephen, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you've been watching and what you've been playing?
Well, recently I've gotten into the show Torchwood. I've been watching some back episodes. It's a BBC show that's a spin-off of Doctor Who.
Interesting.
So it's fairly obscure.
And this is different than the remake of Doctor Who that they've been playing for?
Oh, yeah, this is a spin-off of the remake of Doctor Who, so it's even more obscure. It's the more adult, I guess, version that they show later at night that has more adult themes. I don't know, but it's an interestingly good show, and... it's achieved some notoriety in Britain for being the first really prominent show to have a hero who's a bisexual character.
Interesting.
That's not really why I watch the show. But that's...
I see now why you watch that night, adult themes, bisexual character. I think I see a trend here, Stephen.
Anyway, I've been watching those back episodes, and those are a lot of fun. And then as for what I've been playing, yes, Rock Band, unfortunately, more than I should, and some Flash games, including Bloons Tower Defense 3, which is not as good as Super Energy Apocalypse, but can be played like while you're doing something completely with your mind that is not the game.
Like sleeping.
Is that the one where like the little things go in waves across the screen? You have to build like the trail of towers for them to walk
through?
No,
that's Ninjas vs. Pirates, I think you're thinking.
No, it's not Ninjas vs. Pirates.
It might be Desktop Tower Defense.
I think it's Desktop Tower Defense I'm thinking of, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, this is all with balloons.
Every tower defense game ever made.
that's a good point.
The things kind of go across the screen and you have to make the trail of towers to defeat
kill
them.
The things,
yeah,
right.
That sounds like...
Great.
All right.
Well, what I've been watching, so this week didn't catch any movies at the theater, but I did catch a couple of movies on TV, stuff I haven't seen. I watched Deja Vu, which was a 2006 movie with the Denzel and Val Kilmer and Jim Caviezel, which is this really hacky sort of sci-fi time machine series.
And you can only time travel 3 days.
So... This is another thing. So I love time travel movies, but I hated this movie with a passion just because they got everything so incredibly wrong. Like, they play at trying to have a scientific edge to it, and yet they clearly go completely off the rails and try to make up their own story with huge, huge plot inconsistencies. And I don't know, maybe it's just the geek part of me that just couldn't stand it, but it was a terrible movie for a sci-fi aficionado. It felt like he was speaking down to the audience, like it was being like, oh, you're stupid, you won't understand this, we can do whatever we want. So
do we have a clip from that? We need to play a clip from that.
I'll find a clip. I'll post one on here, but it's bad stuff. I would not recommend it at all.
So even more obnoxious than like zoom in, enhance. Zoom in, enhance.
No, it's even worse than that. And like I'm okay with like pseudoscience technology. It's just they had huge problems with temporal plot stuff, and it's like, really, guys? Did someone just not notice that? Did you just get to a point and you're like, ah, screw it, we gotta finish this movie somehow?
You find yourself exploring time travel, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and the machine that helps you do it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How hard was it to wrap your brain around this concept for the movie?
Well, you know, Tony Scott, who's a great director, we worked three times together now, Crimson Tide, Man on Fire, and Deja Vu. His whole thing was, he said he didn't want to make a science fiction movie. He wanted to make a science fact movie.
Well, yeah. You know what? You're Denzel. You can make it whatever you want to make it.
That's right.
Either way, terrible movie. But if you're looking for a good time travel movie, and I will always recommend this movie, I highly recommend this small independent film called Primer. It is absolutely wonderful. It's smart. It does things well.
It's guaranteed not to make any sense.
Always recommend that movie. Absolutely wonderful for if you're into time travel. The other movie I watched on TV, caught on TNT HD, was The Last Castle, which was a Robert Redford movie. Had a Mark Ruffalo starring in it as well. So this, it looked kind of interesting. It was this sort of a military prison thing, and Rob Redford is this general who gets placed, court-martialed and placed in this military prison run by this very mean and very, you know, sinister prison master. But in the end, it ended up being just sort of a very watered-down Shawshank Redemption, and it never got beyond that point. It was like, oh yeah, Shawshank Redemption, that was such a great movie, we should try to make a version of that and we have our own twist on the theme of it, and it really failed. It is a very flat movie, a very stupid plot, also not a huge recommend, but it's fun though, seeing a bunch of prison people being able to take down a Black Hawk helicopter with stuff that apparently you can make from various prison garbs.
Nasty socks, mostly.
Exactly. And of course, I caught the season premiere of Lost, now in its fifth season. Unlike Scott, I really like Lost. I thought it sort of went off the rails a bit in season three, but got back on form by the end of season four. I really enjoyed the opener. I thought maybe it got a little slow toward the end, but definitely, if you're a Lost fan, you're watching this already, so I have no need to tell you to watch it.
It's, if you hate the show, you'll hate it still. If you love the show, you'll love it still. And if you're somewhere in the middle, that's not going to change.
Exactly. And it's not like you're going to miss it, because they're showing it pretty much nonstop this week.
Yeah, I think it's about all I have. And every night it's like, watch the season
premiere.
ABC is
ready to make you believe.
So games I've been playing this week, haven't played any huge games through, but I did play the demos for two games. One is called The Maw, and The Maw is this independent game that was at PAX, won the PAX People's Choice Award. Also a finalist at the Independent Games Festival, made by this small group called Twisted Pixel. Actually, a really fun game. It's sort of a platformer game where you control this little purple glob that must eat things, and as it eats things, it gets bigger, and if it eats something, it takes on the properties of that thing. Surprisingly slick, surprisingly good-looking. Controls are very responsive. I was incredibly impressed by even the demo of this game, and I'm definitely going to purchase it. It's an Xbox Live game that you can purchase, so huge props to that. If you're looking for a short subject game, something you can finish within a couple of hours, definitely go check out The Maw.
That's Xbox Live Arcade and not Community, correct?
Yes, this was an Xbox Live Arcade game that was developed on the XNA platform. So originally it was in the Community sphere, but did so well that it got pushed onto Xbox Live. And I think it did that by winning the PAX People's Choice Award. Games like Schizoid were also in that category. So,
yeah, cool stuff. I'll have to check that one out. Yep. I haven't played it yet.
The other demo I played was the Xbox version of Red Alert 3, which is the next entry into the long-running Red Alert series, formerly a Westwood game, now an EA game in the Command & Conquer universe. Absolutely hilarious. Like, I love how corny the game is and how campy the game is. It starts out with, you know, these HD cutscenes with, like, Tim Curry playing the Russian premier and Peter Stormare, who's the V-Dub guy, playing this crazy Russian scientist. It's a really campy title. It looked fun. The only, you know, the eventual problem you're going to get is you're playing a real-time strategy on the Xbox 360. It actually controls relatively well, and I like some of the ideas they had to sort of optimize using the 360 controller to play a real-time strategy. But in the end, you feel like, I really want a mouse and keyboard to do all this stuff. So a game to check out. Again, I only got to play through some of the demo levels, but it was still fun. I like the concept of it. This time it's like the Allies, the Russians, and the Japanese. And the Japanese are headed up by George Takei playing the Japanese emperor. It's
awesome.
It's hilariously awesome. So definitely check it out. Though probably grab it on PC, as I'm sure that's the more enjoyable way of playing this game.
Yeah, I've been meaning to catch that one. I really enjoyed Red Alert 2, and I want to catch it on PC. I just haven't had the time.
Right. Great. So I think that sums up the stuff we've been watching this week. So we're going to go ahead and continue on our top 10 of 2008 series. This time, we're going to jump into video games. So we're going to go through our top 10 video games. For video games, since we obviously don't play as many video games as we watch movies, some of the games may not necessarily have come out in 2008, but they may have been sort of late 2007 titles that we played, and so don't necessarily hold us to strict perfection on getting the release dates on these out and make sure they're actually 2008 titles. But I think for the most part, it's stuff that we played or stuff that was sort of introduced around the 2008 period. But Sean, I'm going to go ahead and let you start us off in the top 10 games of 2008.
All right, cool. Well, these are in no particular order. Each and every one of my top 10 picks is the best in its own specially tailored category.
Awesome.
So without further ado, we will start with the category of Best New IP from Electronic Arts. Now, this was a cool year for EA, actually, because they finally threw some new stuff out there.
Let me clarify. Is this best new IP, and it just happens to be from Electronic Arts, or best new Electronic Arts IP?
Best new Electronic Arts IP, because
awesome.
They came out with several this year.
Yeah, that's true.
They had Dead Space,
Mirror's Edge.
They had some other stuff. Yeah. I'm gonna give this one to Mirror's Edge.
Going. Don't think those clues won't come down here. Hey, getting something on the wires. Shit. Looks like they anticipated you might duck in here and send a sniper team ahead. Snipers out or keep out of their way. Just get your ass through there.
Great.
I was really impressed with the style and the fluidity of the game. It made me feel clumsy by comparison. Now, a little bit more about that later. But enjoyable. Now, I can't say that I finished the game. I didn't actually play much of it at all, but I liked what I played. One thing I like is that the urban style they've got going on is not... They don't try to go for gritty, at least not initially. They've got some darker stuff later on and things like that, but...
Right.
But the brilliant white alabaster with touches of just super saturated color is fabulous. In fact, I was wanting even more, so the first time I played the demo, I'm like, the game itself doesn't look quite like the intro video and stuff, so I even turned up the contrast on my TV going, I want more of this, give me more.
That's awesome.
And really, it feels very fluid. You can push any button on the controller you want, and it does something fluid and doesn't stop, and that's cool. One thing that I was a little disappointed by in the controls was I felt there was far too much context sensitivity. There are like three context buttons in the game, and you have to remember which one does the thing that you want in the situation that you need it. I thought that it could have easily done with some more specific buttons, things for slide, things for grab,
sure,
that weren't just on top of something else, because that actually increased, in my case, the learning curve for the game. Maybe it's just because I'm a gamer by, you know, having been so for many years. But I don't know, Dustin, you played this game. What did you think about the controls?
So yeah, I also play this game. I actually did play all the way through. It's actually sort of a relatively short game, and I know a lot of people have been criticizing DICE and EA for putting out a game that can be finished, you know, if you put your mind into it, can be finished within maybe 4 or 5 hours. Actually,
I like that.
Yeah, I enjoy that. I now, like, when I have less time to play games, I really do enjoy a game I can sit down and feel like I finish, and not a game that I play through and, you know, sits on my shelf, you know, 6 months later, still not finished, and then I feel guilty for having bought it and not finished it. So I'm able to come to a completion, a resolution in a game.
Yeah, sorry. I'm much more likely to replay a game that's 6 hours than I am one that's 100 hours.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think Mirror's Edge actually provides a ton of room for replayability in it, too. So once you play through the main game, you can actually go back and do time trials on the sort of the tracks that you've run, these sort of levels you've run, and that's incredibly compelling too, because like you'll be doing this over and over again. I remember playing like for an hour trying to like shave like a tenth of a second off my time by slightly positioning my character a little bit over to the left so I could cut a little bit off the time where I was running, and it almost becomes like a running race game, which is I think a really cool concept. I really enjoy this game, and as for the control scheme, I was a little iffy on the control scheme. So the way they try to do things is they try to map things on the control to match the context of what you're doing in the game. So you have like the left bumper, which is sort of high, and that makes you jump and do sort of up things. And then you have the left trigger, which is low, has you do stuff like slide and crouch.
Right. Yeah. You basically have high actions and low actions, and that.
My problem though is that it's mapped to the left side of your hand, and the left side of my hand is the left side is where you're controlling the left analog stick, which is how you control the character's movement, character Faith, who's this girl that you're playing, how you control her movement. And to me, having to make sure that both of my fingers were on the trigger and on the left bumper sort of shifted my hand in a way that was slightly uncomfortable, where it felt like my thumb wasn't well rested on the analog stick, and I almost would have liked to be able to sort of have sole control and sole focus of my left hand on just moving my character, which is, you know, a huge part of the things, and then move the sort of jump and the jump command and the slide command to the right stick, which I think actually matches a bit more what other games do. So like games like Halo, where, you know, you have the jump button is on your right hand and all the actions are on your right hand, and sort of move and strafe is your left hand, and that's its sole focus. So
yeah. I really applaud them for trying some new things with the control scheme.
Yeah.
I think they were very bold with their strokes there, and so yeah, they go outside the line some. But they've laid the groundwork for some interesting stuff, and I really hope they follow this game up with more from that.
Now, what I've heard is actually, and now one of the big complaints they got from this game is that the combat in the game is terrible, and I will agree, the combat seems like they didn't put a whole lot of work into it. There are several instances, like combat with an individual person is actually kind of fun. Like, you know, it's this first person fighting sort of game style, and that's reasonably fun. But the problem is anytime you get into combat, and sometimes they force you into combat with multiple people, is you'll be fighting one guy, and you'll kick him, and you have to wait a little while before you can kick him again, or do a context-sensitive grab where you grab his gun and sort of disarm him. But while you're while you're waiting to do that, there's two other guys shooting at you, and within like two shots, you're dead. And it some of those points where you had to fight like three guys got really, really annoying. And the way I wanted to play this game is I wanted to play it where I never fought anyone. And so as much as I could, I'd go through and like a person would be in front of me and like slide kick them, and they'd sort of get knocked aside, and then I'd just run past them and try to run as much as I could. But there are definitely several instances where they were like, no, you must fight. We're going to lock you in this room. There's no way you can unlock this door in time before you get shot until you take these guys out. And to me, if you're not going to spend your focus of your time on the combat, don't make it optional. And I felt like that's what they were trying to do. And I thought that was a cool, bold move to be like, you know what? You can go through this game and not have to fight. You don't have to shoot guns. You don't have to kill people. That's totally optional. In fact, we encourage you to play this as in a sort of pacifist role. But then they have these instances where clearly like, oh, no, you know, we spent money to develop this combat system, so you're going to do combat, dang it, and even if it sucks, you're going to do it. So I felt that was almost kowtowing to sort of the combat-hungry, you know, perception of gamers.
Yeah. One game that this reminded me of heavily, when did this come out? Probably around 2000, I guess. Called Oni. It was a game made by Bungie prior to acquired by Microsoft. Cool little game if you can find it. Highly recommend it. The PC version plays a bit better than the one that came out on PS2, but the PS2 one is prolific and incredibly cheap. You can probably find it someplace for about $5.
True.
All right. My next pick is Best Crossover Fan Fiction. By the company that created the original IP, Super Smash Bros. Brawl. I mean, okay, I loved Melee. I played it for years. This was one of those just perennial favorites. Brawl takes that same recipe, repackages it again, sells it to us a third time, which is fine. I'm cool with that. One of my tenets of business is if you can't sell the same thing twice, it's not worth selling in the first place.
that's a pretty good tenet.
But what made this
too bad nobody ever told Hollywood about that. Oh wait, that's all Hollywood does.
Yeah, well, it seems to work, I guess.
It works fantastically. Anyway, so the absolutely gleeful way in which they present the campaign mode of Brawl, the Subspace Emissary.
Right.
Is just fantastic. I mean, like I say, it's the best crossover fanfic by the creators of the original IP. They imbue each of these, essentially many of them are empty characters,
right?
With so much character, and they allow them to play off of one another in this way throughout their cutscenes in the story. Without any dialogue whatsoever, it's excellent.
That's a good point. All those cutscenes are pure, like, you know, facial animations, you know, and expressions with, you know, no dialogue. Because most of these characters don't have a person to speak for them, and if you did, you know, you'd cause, you know, huge ripples in the Nintendo community. So, that's an interesting point.
And something else, just the way they showcase them so triumphantly, it's a melodrama,
sure,
obviously, but it's one you can totally, you know, cheer the good guys and throw popcorn at the bad guys over. Anyway, let's continue.
Let's move on.
I know we're talking a lot about each one. We should probably carry this along.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
The only one gripe I would have about it is it seems like a lot of Nintendo titles and have sort of gone in what I would say this Square Enix direction with doing these huge sort of fully rendered CG cutscenes. And that was my one gripe with this game is it felt a lot of the stuff felt a little like, Kingdom Heartsy or, other, Square Enix sort of style CG cutscenes. And to me, while that's cool and I like seeing that stuff, when I play a game, I want to play the game and I don't want to watch the movie. And I like being rewarded, like in Warcraft 3, you got rewarded for beating one of the campaigns by seeing one of these really cool cutscenes. But it felt like they almost replaced a lot of the cool gameplay in this with cutscenes. And that's where I really disagree with that use of cutscenes. And to me, that feels like a very Japanese Square Enix sort of Final Fantasy thing to do. But yeah, beyond that, still, I think, as fun as any of the other Smash Brothers titles and a good iteration on it, especially for the Wii. So.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's move on.
Okay. So next one up, you already know my affiliations, but I'm going to throw out this shameless self-promotion, best post-apocalyptic game about energy efficiency and zombies.
I wonder what this could be.
Super Energy Apocalypse.
When the zombies sang a catchy song, it went trash, 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 yum, yum, yum. Then we fried them with our flame turrets in the sea. Super Energy Apocalypse.
I just want to point out one of the proudest moments of this game was a review from Jaya's Games, the original site to which it was the original version of the game was submitted. Buggy as all get out, and just, very, very rough draft. But now that we released the update, he's given it a proper review and says, it took a lot of work, but the end result is one of the most enjoyable and fun educational games ever created. And I was completely floored by that comment. I thought, maybe we've got something here. So I won't spend any more time on the shameless self-promotion, but
sure.
Maybe you should check that
out. But Scott and Steven, I know you guys both played a lot of this game, so Scott, why don't you go ahead and chime in on this?
Well, speaking of a lack of shameless self-promotion, there is no song at the end of this game that has to be listened to, otherwise your life is incomplete, so I'll just get that out of the way. Nor was that written by any member of the daily or weekly monotony team.
Exactly.
Except Scott.
Except maybe one of them, but this is a game about energy efficiency and real-time strategy. If you haven't played a real-time strategy in Flash before, you probably owe it to yourself. It's not quite Masters of Orion 4, but it's close. And there are mutant alien zombies, and you get to kill them, and that always seems like good enough a reason for any gamer to stop and play something. So why not?
Also, the song at the end, which does in fact exist, is quite hilarious.
Yeah, actually, one of the funny things was we were getting a lot of comments about this game that were like, well, I was going to give it a 4, but then I heard the song 5 out of 5.
That's always a good way. And actually, I think that's sort of an interesting thing as to the sort of the Portal effect. Is like, Portal was a great game, but the Jonathan Coulton, still live song at that, I think really sealed it as probably one of the best games of 2007 and still, that thinking about that game, gives me, warm, glowy, fuzzy feelings. So,
yeah, it's the cherry on top effect.
Exactly.
Everything is perfect, and then there's a cherry on top.
Right.
And it just seals the whole package. So,
right.
Thanks, Scott, very much for all of your hard work in making sure we had a tasty little cherry on the top of our game.
Well, as long as the cake's not a lie, there might as well be a cherry for it.
Exactly. Okay, on to the next one. Best post-apocalyptic game, not about energy efficiency, but with zombies anyway.
I wonder what this could be.
This is Fallout 3.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart I have but one desire, and that one is you. No other will do. I've lost all ambition for worldly acclaim. I just want to be the one you love. And with your admission that you feel the same, I'll have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't set the world.
Never changes.
I was obsessed with this game, and I still have some blogging that I need to do about it, which has an intro on Daily Monotony and no additional content.
Which will be up at some time in the future.
Yes, it will be. Maybe even this year.
Perhaps.
So one of the things that I really liked about the game was it just seemed to draw the typical mechanics of this genre into a setting where they really strike a chord. Because oftentimes you're wondering, you know, why is a shopkeeper selling me all of these fantastic items for adventuring when I'm the only one in the entire world who goes adventuring?
Right.
Maybe it's because killing enemies is so dang lucrative. I don't know. But anyway, this the effect I felt when first playing this game was that of being a scavenger, being a survivor out in the wastes, and I liked that feeling, just sort of trekking out and seeing what's out there, and for being an empty wasteland, there's quite a bit, so I really liked that. I love the setting, the cheeky humor and quirky style with the cold, desolate post nuclear wasteland. It's great. One thing I'm gonna call it out on though is its totally bogus portrayal of radiation and radioactivity and Fallout in general. For a game called Fallout, they could do at least 30 seconds of research as to what Fallout actually does. And
sure,
unfortunately, they didn't.
I think it's easy to spare them that one, though, for artistic portrayal.
Sure. I mean, they really go with the popular idea of Fallout rather than a scientific one.
Sure.
So I suppose we can give them that. But even so, 200 years after a nuclear apocalypse, excuse me, there's no way that food is still going to be irradiated. It's just
true, and you're probably not going to have, you know, two-headed cows and many of the other things presented. But
now,
what do you mean? We have lots of those.
I was a little more apt to give them things like two-headed cows and super mutants and giant radiation scorpions and things. I don't know why. Maybe it's because that sort of thing is like, oh, well, maybe I guess that could happen, but you know.
Cool. Well,
the main thing was you didn't really have to worry about radiation management in Fallout. I tend to agree. It's not something you were ever really scared about. And it seems like that would have been a really cool gameplay element to be constantly worried about your climbing radiation.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I think they build in a mechanic for you to be able to. So if you don't have, you know, health packs and stuff, like, you can drink water and you can eat food and all that stuff gives you radiation, but there are definitely plenty of ways to get around it. But sort of with it, to paint some broad strokes on this, Fallout 3 is Bethesda's new game of this year, and Bethesda are the same people who brought us the Elder Scrolls series, which was Oblivion was their last game, which was a huge, huge hit for the Xbox 360. And the Fallout series is actually a really old series too, and Fallout 3 is a sort of more of a spiritual successor than a real successor to the previous Fallout game. The previous Fallout games are very much of this kind of a isometric viewpoint role playing game, very much I guess like a what are the games that I'm trying to think this is close to, like Baldur's Gate sort of that
yeah,
kind of
the
style.
Baldur's Gate, it's the Infinity Engine, anything with that, Icewind Dale, all that sort of thing.
Right. So this was a huge shift for the product, and I know a lot of people were very nervous about taking the sort of beloved Fallout game, which hasn't had a new game in a long, long time, like at least 10 years, and sort of putting it in this, basically putting it in the Oblivion universe, in this first-person perspective where you're playing a role-playing game through the first-person perspective. And I have to say, you know, you have to give props to Bethesda. They really know what they're doing when it comes to translating the role-playing elements into a first-person, into first-person gameplay elements, into a first-person perspective. Like, I don't think there's anyone else I can say does this as well as Bethesda does, and they always seem to put so much effort into making sure that it's of the highest quality and you know, it's really slickly put out. Even if the first-person action is not as slick as some other first-person games, like a first-person shooter, which is actually where some of my gripes come with Fallout 3, is I think, well, it's a fun game to play. Everything is based around shooting, essentially. They make passes at melee combat, but it's mostly a first-person RPG shooter. And while they introduce this cool system called VATS, which lets you basically pause the game and choose where you want to shoot at stuff and turn it into this kind of pseudo turn-based strategy game, or turn-based role-playing game, it's like eventually you have to get into the first-person shooting mechanics, and when you actually start shooting stuff in this first-person mode, I think that's where some of the seams start to show on the game. Is it's really not very good. It's not, you don't move responsively enough to, like a first-person shooter, to really play it effectively. And to me, the shooting felt like wildly inaccurate too. Like, I'd shoot a bullet and go like flying off at like a 30-degree angle and stuff like that. And some of those things just felt jarring, just coming from a first person, you know, coming from a long train of great first person titles. And I don't know, how did you guys feel about the way they accomplished the combat in Fallout 3?
I really liked it. I understand your complaint with the aiming. It was a little frustrating because they would introduce error into what you were shooting. It wouldn't shoot exactly where you expect,
right?
Because that's where your reticle is, like most first-person shooters.
Right.
However, my characters that I made concentrated on having a huge amount of VATS time, so that they were able to play mostly in the role-playing element,
right?
Which maybe that's why I enjoyed it so much. But I didn't find that to be a fairly big fault of the game. I just, you know, it just seems the cost of doing business. Otherwise, why would you use the sort of role-playing mode?
Sure.
If there was no incentive.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And once you found some of the unique weapons that actually did shoot where you wanted anyway, it was not an issue, but I guess you didn't get that far.
I most definitely did. I still just, like, I have a problem when, you know, you get a gun like the minigun, which is this huge gun that shoots a spray of bullets, and I go at some, you know, super mutant, and I'm spraying him with a minigun, and, like, none of the bullets are hitting him. He's not taking any damage. To me, that's where I just kind of say, like, really, guys? Like, I'm shooting a big gun here, and sure, I may not have, like, the most heavy weapons proficiency, but some of these bullets should be hitting him, because this guy's, like, 5 feet in front of me, and I'm shooting him with a chain gun.
Yeah, if you have it pointed in his general direction, there's enough bullets there that he's gonna be dead.
No, but that's the thing. It wasn't. It's like,
just because, and just because you are not very good with this weapon doesn't mean it should cause bullets to exit the barrel at 30-degree angles.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I'm agreeing with you here, totally.
Okay, yeah.
Did any of y'all play Knights of the Old Republic? Now, this was BioWare and then Black Isle.
Yeah, KOTOR, which...
But little bit different in terms of style, but they did the same thing. You know, it's all based off of this D20 system that's, you roll a die and see if you hit,
right?
And if it's wildly off,
right,
they would just send that laser out of the end of the gun at
who knows
crazy
where
angles.
Right.
And if you were really close to the other guy, these could be ridiculous.
And I'm totally fine with that in, like, the kind of turn-based, you know, combat that KOTOR had, and that even like the VATS system provided. But when I'm in thinking first-person mode, I expect when I shoot a bullet, it to go at least in a general vicinity of where I'm shooting it. And that that I found incredibly annoying, especially because one of the big issues of this game is ammo management and gun management. And, you know, your stuff breaks down, or you don't have a whole lot of bullets for it until, you know, unless you know you game the system and you, like, you're in a very, you know, high level and you've bought a lot of stuff.
Right.
But getting off the gameplay mechanics, let's talk about the story and the missions. How did you guys feel this game lived up to, say, you know, other RPGs, other Fallout games, or maybe even Oblivion, Bethesda's previous title?
Well, if I can interject briefly, I mean, I spent most of my sophomore year in college playing Oblivion with no apologies about that, and I took a good shot at playing most of my senior year in college on Fallout 3. But one problem which gave Oblivion infinite playtime value, maybe not replay value, but at least initial playtime value, that Fallout 3 seems to lack is the sheer variety, depth, and availability of quests.
Yeah.
In Oblivion, if you walk anywhere, into any tavern, if you walk around, quests constantly are filling your journal. New conversation topic, boy missing, random artifact you found. If you just walk across the countryside, you'll find dozens of different locations, all of which have gajillions of quests, if not just, you know, are huge dungeons that you can crawl and meet cool monsters and ghosts and bandits and stuff. In Fallout 3, the quests, will maybe being a little bit better written, are very sparse. You know, I'd been playing the game for maybe 50 hours and I had like 6 quests total in my journal. It's like find dad, do this thing, do the other thing, FedEx quest, and, you know, visit this museum.
Right.
You know, vis-a-vis in Oblivion, I would have 50 quests by then. And Oblivion had a lot of very enjoyable side quests, the Thieves Guild, the Arena, the Mages Guild, beyond the main quest.
Some big side quests that were very, very unique in style. And
in some of them had some really great content, some really great writing. If any of what he did, you know, the Dark Brotherhood quest in Oblivion, that was pretty fantastic.
Like the Thieves Guild quest, or the Thieves Guild line in Oblivion, that was my favorite quest, period, beyond the main quest. It was just incredibly unique and incredibly compelling. It, not only the stuff you did, but the things you ended up doing for the final mission. It was so different from everything else you did in Oblivion, which I made that, you know, really stand out. And I agree. I don't think Fallout 3 had that.
And even in Fallout 3, where you have big side quests like that, you know, you miss out on a lot of the things that made them so rewarding in Oblivion. The interesting parts of the game you wouldn't otherwise get to visit, the really cool artifacts, the cool pads you get once you become the head of the Thieves Guild or the head of the Mages Guild or the head of the Fighters Guild or what have you.
Right.
And in the same way, the sort of open-ended flexibility of Oblivion, you know, you don't have to do any of those quests. You don't have to do the main quest. You can be a good guy. You can be a bad guy. You can live in a bunch of different towns. You don't even have to visit some towns if you don't want to.
Right.
That sort of extreme flexibility and open-endedness that they like to talk about in an open world, I don't really think you see as much of in Fallout. It's, you know, there are two places you can live in Fallout 3. You know, in order to really do very much that's interesting, you do have to play some of the main quest, at least initially. The side quests aren't hours and hours of gameplay, like becoming, you know, the Archmage.
Right. Yeah, one of my biggest problems, I'll give that Fallout 3, the main quest is compelling and fun. I really enjoyed it. I love the sort of ending they had, this kind of ending that you kind of get to take part of, but you're not, it doesn't really rely on you that much. Just a really fun sequence. But my biggest problem, and this is what I loved about Oblivion and really didn't like about Fallout 3, is that Fallout 3 ends. There is a clear end to the game. Once you beat the game, it's over. There's a credit roll and you're back to the start screen. And while sure you can always go back to a save and play everything else, the thing that I loved about Oblivion is that when you beat the main quest, not only did the game not end, you could keep on playing, but there's this marker that, you know, there's been this huge event that happened, and there's, you know, this statue placed up of, you know, where this big event happened. As you play through the rest of the quest and you walk by that, you're like, I remember that. I remember when I fought in the battle of something, and there's that cool sense of persistence in the universe that I think you kind of lost in Fallout 3. And like, and also, you know, as you're walking around Oblivion, you know, people be like, hey, you're the, you know, you're the hero of Cyrodiil, and like, you know, thanks for saving us. And in this game, you just don't get that at all. So, I think that was, I don't know, I think it was a sort of reckless move for Fallout 3 to take in some ways, after, how well Oblivion had been done. But, I definitely don't think it ruins the game. I want to make sure that, people understand that I really did love Fallout 3, and it was a fun game, and I think it does what Bethesda does well, which is immersing you into an environment and making you really feel like you're a part of this place, and make you feel like you care for characters. And so definitely still a very good game, even if there are some gripes about it.
Next in my list here, best game to play with friends. Rock Band 2. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. I mean, I just there's a lot to like about the game, and I think it really does everything that it sets out to do extremely well.
So here's the question I want to pose is, now I have Rock Band 2 recently. I started playing it, and I'll admit Rock Band 2 is on my top 10 games list. But is it really Rock Band 2 that's fun, or is it Rock Band that's fun? Because I don't feel like there was much iteration on Rock Band 2 other than there's new songs, which you can get just by downloading or buying new songs for Rock Band 1. Do you guys feel that Rock Band 2, that iteration, was really worthy of being a best game of this year? Or is it just that the Rock Band experience of playing Rock Band, you know, with four people or at a party with friends is just always very fun?
I like Rock Band 2 quite a bit. I mean, it seems a lot more refined, a lot better as a party game and just as a rhythm game than the original Rock Band. I mean, you've got, you know, drums that actually last for a while. The gameplay seems a little bit more refined, and the interface is a lot better. Ultimately, is it the same game? Well, yeah, but so was Guitar Hero 3 and Guitar Hero 2 and Guitar Hero 1.
Sure.
You know, rhythm games are fun. DDR is fun for people who like
sure,
DDR.
Sure, but like, take the Guitar Hero World Tour. Like, they actually made an effort, like, when they were going into the full band sort of mechanics of Rock Band, they you know, went through the process of, you know, adding like a, you know, write your own song thing, and you know, they made the drum kit have cymbals on it. Like, it really did feel like a huge sort of, you know, upgrade.
Actually, that's something I want to talk about.
Yeah, go ahead.
The write your own jam session feature in Guitar Hero World Tour.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, from my observation, was entirely marketing. Now, it was good marketing, but it was a bullet point feature they could put on their box that Rock Band 2 could not. Rock Band and Rock Band 2 have this je ne sais quoi about them.
Right.
Now, I can point to several things that I definitely like about them better than Guitar Hero World Tour,
mm-hmm.
but for most people, it is definitely an I don't know what, but I like this game better.
Right.
And unfortunately, that doesn't sell your game over the other guy.
Sure.
Who's like, we have this feature.
Right.
You can't do that on the other system.
Right.
Let me tell you what I think that je ne sais quoi is. First of all, people that are attractive. Good lord. The character models in Guitar Hero World Tour are ugly. I never want to look at them. And in fact, they look best from as far away as possible. I mean, World Tour does the it looks like you're in a concert viewpoint very well. They have some cool depth of field and some other stuff, and the lighting looks good when the camera's out above the crowd. But it looks so bad on stage. I mean, they've got, like, last-gen colored lighting and just Oh, just, it's ugly. It's so ugly. Rock Band 2, on the other hand, I'm not sure about Rock Band. I think they had a similar look for things, but just the way the characters look is far more attractive. The lighting on stage looks nice.
Right.
When it pans out over the crowd, it looks okay, too.
Sure. And to some degree, you're not really watching or noticing that stuff. Like, it should be unnoticeable. You're playing the game. You want to focus on what you're playing. And it doesn't stick out as being bad, whereas I would agree with you. In Guitar Hero, the avatars do stick out as being distracting and really ugly looking and, like, very, very bizarre looking. So,
Yeah. The other thing, I just feel like they tend to match the rhythm and the cadence of the song better with the activity in Rock Band or Rock Band 2. And yeah, I think you're right. They're probably more of the same, but I think that may have been the same sort of marketing deal.
Sure.
As
and this is kind of how I would, I guess, put my summary statement on it, is that Rock Band the series is still really fun, and this year with the new iteration, even if it's just for the new songs and, you know, arguably the much better peripherals, it's still really fun, and it's still, I think, the king of the sort of group rhythm game experience. And
yeah, it's a great party game.
Right. Yeah. So go ahead.
If I can address the two sort of, I guess, additional features that you have in Guitar Hero World Tour. One is cymbals. Well, you can do cymbals for Rock Band. They actually have a plug-in, and, you know, if you feel compelled to do that.
Do they sell peripherals, though? Or do you have to,
uh-huh.
like... Oh, yeah. I did not realize that.
There's peripheral cymbals you can buy that go up there. You can get two or three.
I don't think I've ever seen them.
And also, the songwriting thing, while it sounds fascinating to me, from what I've read about it, it seems like it's very time-consuming.
Sure.
And so I think the average user probably won't ever write a song.
In practice, it's very difficult once you feed a song in to get the beats synced up.
Interesting.
Without a meticulously calibrated TV and a very musical finger,
right,
so to speak. And furthermore, once you've taken the time to carefully input a custom song in Rock Band, you'll probably want to beam it to all of your friends. But that's disabled, presumably for copyright features.
Right,
you know,
right.
That song's never leaving your own console.
Yeah, definitely run into the DRM issue there and the sort of copyright management stuff. So, yeah, it's an unfortunate thing, but does, I think, sort of nerf that that particular feature.
Yeah. Any other comments?
I think that's about it. I think we can say that definitely Rock Band and Rock Band 2 are still really fun games to play with a lot of people. And even, I would say, a fun game to play on your own if you like rhythm games.
Sure.
And Visions is still terrible on Expert.
As always. Great.
Except on vocal.
Well, great. Well, let's move on to Sean's next game.
My next game is actually a Flash game, but it is so fantastic, you're going to love it. It is, in fact, the best game this year about extinction. Dino Run.
Interesting.
It's this game. You play as this little dinosaur. Looks kind of like a Compsognathus or something like that. Just a little sort of super, super cute.
Yeah, the little dinosaurs from Lost World, right?
Yeah. The whole game visual style is very chunky pixels, very big swaths of flat color, but they pull it off extremely well and get a bit of an impressionist vibe, if you will,
interesting,
from it.
Well, I think this is probably a game that it's a game I haven't heard about, and I'm sure probably Scott and Steven haven't, and I'm sure probably a lot of our listeners have never heard about. So why don't you explain a little bit about what the game is?
Okay, here's what it's about. You play as this little dinosaur, and the premise of the game is that the planet killer meteor has just hit the Earth. And so what you need to do is run as fast as you can away from this expanding wall of doom. And it's basically a run through the race course game. And you pick up little eggs along the way to save your genetic line from extinction. And you can also pick up other types of dinosaur eggs that are special eggs along the way. And then you can use these points for getting those to improve various bits of your dino. There are challenge modes. There's head-to-head. There's some really cool features of the game that I haven't even really explored, but it's fantastic. And it's all built in Flash, so it just runs on your computer. It doesn't matter what you've got.
Hmm.
Runs quite fast, I might add, which is certainly a boon because the game is about feeling like you're going
fast.
You're
moving fast, right?
Feeling like flow. Now, you go over, you know, hills, rocky terrain, there are trees. You can, as you run along, you can leap up, and if there's like a low-flying pterodactyl, he'll catch you and he'll carry you along for a certain period. But if you tarry too long, then the wall of doom, as they call it, will catch up to you. And this is this massive black, you know, cloud of dust and debris and stuff that you're trying to outrun.
Right. So now it sounds like an interesting game, but why does this game particularly make it on your top 10 list? Like, why should I go play this rather than, like, you know, one of the millions of other, you know, Flash games that are available?
You should play this game particularly for its atmosphere and particularly for its flow. For one thing, it does speed in side-scrolling the best I've seen since Sonic.
Hmm. That's pretty high praise.
Yeah. Secondly, it does this in Flash, which is simply amazing.
That's pretty impressive, yeah.
And the other, just the endearing graphics and the super cute little character juxtaposed with the terror and impending doom of utter death and extinction is amazing, and it will affect you. There's
I'll admit,
something.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen this game being played. And it is there is sort of something distinctly hypnotic about it. I'll admit I was into a lot of the speed horizontal scrollers all the way back to Sonic, in fact. And this certainly looks like a pretty good one. You'll enjoy it for at least a few hours, if not longer than that, as you sort of go into the deeper nitty-gritty parts of the game, you know, the ability to tweak the character and such. So it's probably worth checking out. Certainly a little bit more intelligent, it feels like, in the design than some other Flash games you might encounter on the interwebs.
Cool. And absolutely. And where might we find this particular game?
I believe you can just go Google Dino Run.
Okay.
Let me check and see what website it... It is pixeljam.com/dinorun.
Great. Well, cool. That sounds fun. I think people across many different age boundaries and gender boundaries really love to play online Flash games, so this sounds like a good one to play. Let's go ahead and wrap it up and move on to your next game.
Okay, one more quick comment about why you should play Dino Run. Two words, Doom Surf. If that wall of doom catches up to you, you can keep going, even slightly within it, as long as you don't let it entirely cover the screen. And the game will count up as long as you are right on the cusp of destruction, and when you finally do get free, if you do, it tallies that up and gives you points for however many seconds of doom surf you have achieved, and that was, I have to say, one of the most tense, adrenaline-pumping moments I've had in gaming in the past year. So,
sweet.
There you go.
Very
That's
cool.
Dino. Next one. I'm not sure which way I should do these two games. I'll go with best game for spontaneously inducing puberty, growing hair on your chest, and generally maxing out the points on your man card.
I'm looking forward to this one.
Gears of War 2.
I have a rendezvous with death. At some disputed barricade. It may be he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. I have a rendezvous with death. And I to my pledged word am true. I shall not fail that rendezvous.
Without a doubt, the dialogue in this game is hilarious. Absolutely so macho it hurts design of each character. And the differentiation between the characters, you know, it's not what body type they are or what their sort of emotions are. It is literally what magnitude of huge they are. Are they big? Are they thick? Are they extremely huge? Are they ridiculous? And this is a scale, you know?
Yep.
The idea of an assault rifle with a chainsaw bayonet is
It's pretty extreme, yeah. Was this your first foray into the Gears of War series?
Yes, in fact it was. I did not play the first one in any meaningful way.
Okay.
I may have gotten into a game or two. I can't really recall. Right. I know my brothers played it.
Right.
So I can't really compare to the first one, but I definitely like the sort of roller coaster ride, as I've heard some other reviewers put it, of the narrative.
Right.
It definitely takes you for a ride, and I agree with one particular person who said, you know, maybe it's better that the story itself is fairly mediocre, kind of cliche, not particularly outstanding, because it allows you to just enjoy the game and go along for the ride without a huge amount of thought put into it.
Sure. So for everyone, Gears of War 2 is, of course, the sequel to Epic's Gears of War for the Xbox 360. It's an exclusive title for 360. The first Gears of War, you know, smashed away all the, you know, the awards. A very fun title, hailed up by Cliff Bleszinski, who's sort of Epic's kind of rock star figure, and actually very much a rock star figure in the game design world. I'm going to speak to Gears of War 2 a bit more when I get to my list, but I'll go ahead and let Scott hail in on this one, because I know you've been playing this one, and we played through the original Gears of War on co-op before, so go for it.
Gears of War seems like a great game to go through on a co-op campaign, either over Xbox Live or with another person there in the room. You know, it's a lot of fun, you know, running through things together, getting each other up when your head gets shot off, which it does 5 times a minute. In terms of Gears of War 2 as compared to its predecessor in the series, I don't think there's a whole lot new in terms of achievement that they've done there. Most of the same weapons are back exactly as you know them. A couple of random pistols or what have you that have been thrown in. The way they've structured the achievements in Gears of War 2, I think, is a lot better than the first one. You know, the little progress bars pop up for the number of heads you've blown off or weapons you've used to decapitate someone as you go.
That's pretty cool.
it certainly adds, for the people who are number cruncher gamers, you know, who like to get all the badges, all of the achievements, who like scoring up things.
Right.
I think that's a great little mechanism for those people to get into and
enjoy. That seems to be kind of a trend too, because like Halo 3 had the scoring system where you could play through a level and sort of get an arcade score as you go. So it seems to be a trend that some of the big AAA titles are following, which is a trend I like particularly.
It is a lot of fun as I sit there and, you know, have to double check to make sure I didn't forget to use the torque bow to blow somebody's face off to get the Varieties of Spice of Death achievement. But is it particularly revolutionary or groundbreaking over the first Gears of War? No, it feels very much like an expansion pack, a sort of continuation with just, you know, careful tweaks and refinements made as they go along. But still, the first game was quite enjoyable and a big blast, and the second game didn't change that.
Cool.
Just to be clear, we are really talking about this game in a cooperative campaign sense, which is,
gotcha,
in my opinion, one of the best ways to play first-person shooters from the original Halo on.
Sure.
But I recognize and I have heard of some real problems in the competitive multiplayer mode of the game.
Right. You know, so that's my next question. I know a lot of work was done into Gears of War 2 to make it a more balanced multiplayer or competitive multiplayer experience. There's a lot of gripes about the original Gears of War that it was basically gameable. You could do this thing called a shotgun roll where basically you could, that's what everyone ended up doing. You had this sort of hack that everyone was doing on all the servers, and people got ridiculously good at it. So the point where if you went in, you played, you basically, unless you were one of those, you know, one of those guys who was really awesome in Gears of War, you just couldn't play the Gears of War multiplayer experience. Have you guys played any of the Gears of War 2 multiplayer? Or the competitive multiplayer?
I'm afraid I haven't, yeah.
Okay. I played a little bit of it.
Okay, Steven, why don't you tell us about what you thought?
Oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, okay, I didn't play a whole lot, but I played for, you know, maybe, I don't know, 30 minutes to an hour one time when I had a friend over who had the game, and it didn't seem particularly fun to me on the scale of, like, Halo multiplayer being particularly fun. You know, but then again, I was learning the game mechanics as I went along,
sure.
So my initial impression was not great, but not bad, and I'd have to sort of revise that later.
Right. No, I've heard a lot of... go ahead, yeah.
And this is probably going to be heresy for many people who love multiplayer first-person shooters. But I think that first-person shooters on online play just have some fundamental problems with them that cannot be overcome versus face-to-face in the same room on the same TV or even land up. You know, the original
screen
Halo
looker
fantastic for being able to just land some Xboxes together and have a party. I don't feel the same way about Halo 2 online multiplayer. I think one of the reasons is simply the factor of everyone on the internet is better than you.
I agree. There's always, I think, that been that sort of learning curve on first-person competitive multiplayer games. Not that it means that there aren't a lot of fun ones out there. I enjoyed Call of Duty 4 to death. It was a great competitive multiplayer experience. But I do feel the Gears series in general has always suffered from being very much you're either an expert at this game or you just can't play it. Like, I don't think they've ever done matchmaking incredibly well. And I would say even with Gears of War 2 or the competitive aspect of multiplayer, it still feels that way. Like, I go on, I feel like I die really quickly, and it's like, great, this is fun.
One thing that I love about playing these games, multiplayer, is that you get to know the play styles and the dispositions and the sort of personalities in-game of other players, and I don't feel like I get that as much when my opponents are constantly being recycled from everyone online.
Sure, sure.
Which is why I like playing with my friends a lot.
Right. Then, Sean, let's move on to your next game.
Okay, this one is a complete opposite of the previous game. This is the best game. Oh, by the way, this one technically came out in 07, but it was a December 07 release, so we're kind of fudging the line a little bit.
That works.
Anyway, this is the best game about a mermaid princess who rides seahorses and sings rainbow-colored songs. And that one goes to Aquaria.
was enveloped by warm light as familiarity overwhelmed me. I had come home. Some time ago, I built this small kitchen in the center of my cave. Here, I would combine ingredients found throughout Aquaria to create new foods. Certain recipes proved to be very useful.
Aquaria is an indie game by probably one of the rock stars of the indie scene, Derek Yu. And he runs the acclaimed TIG Source. That's the indie game source.
Right.
And Aquaria was a work of love for him over several years. Won the Seamus McNally Grand Prize in IGF back in like 07 or maybe 06. Anyway, the game has atmosphere to the limit. It's beautiful. It's kind of a Metroidvania style, if you're familiar with that genre.
Sure.
In that, you know, the kind 2D of exploration.
Explore a big environment and slowly expand what you can move into.
Exactly, exactly. There's a small disappointment in that the beginning of the game feels so peaceful and refreshing and different, and then the first area that you really explore, you get power to you get power of destruction and essentially now the ability to attack anything on screen, which sort of kills that feeling, but maybe that's what they were going for.
Sure.
Some things that make this game really stand out. The voice acting is really good, and it's done all from a first-person perspective in terms of storytelling.
So what do you mean by, someone saying, explain that, I guess.
Okay, yeah. Well, the game itself is third-person perspective, obviously.
Right.
But the character herself, Nyjah, speaks during the story to narrate it.
Interesting.
Her
feelings.
And her thoughts.
Speaks, you playing the character, she speaks as her own particular thoughts.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
Yes. It's very interesting. You sort of guide her through the game, but she provides her own commentary on what she's going through and what she feels throughout the story.
Now, go ahead.
Some of it's a little cheesy, but overall I think it works.
So I'll say another game that did something similar to that was the first-person shooter Prey. And in that game, you play a particular character that you're introduced to, but you're playing, it's a first-person shooter, so you're playing from the first-person perspective. And as you're going through stuff, the character will speak, and he'll actually say stuff. And I remember the first time I was playing that game, I heard someone talking. I'm like, who's saying that? And then, after a while, he starts talking again. I'm like, who's talking? Is there some guy near me? And then I realized it was me who was talking. It was my character who was talking. I actually found that, at least from the first-person perspective, I found that very weird. It's like I no longer identified with the character because now he was speaking for himself, and I was that was not me playing. That was this dude who's playing on there. So I actually found it a little off-putting in Prey, but it sounds like it works in Aquarius.
Yeah, I think the third-person perspective with the first-person voiceover works very well because it allows you to say, yes, that's me, that's my character, but have just enough distance to understand that you are role-playing a character and that that character is not, in fact, your own personality.
Okay.
Overall, fantastic game. Highly recommend it.
And I assume this can be found at the TIG Source?
You can find it through TIG Source. You can also find it at bitblot.com, I believe. That's bit-blot.
Great. I remember when this game came out, and I was still living with you guys in the apartment, and I remember Lars freaking out about this game and running into his room and locking the door and many hours later came out being I just beat the game. So So it sounds like one of those great fun independent Flash game. Is it a Flash game? I should say, or is it a
no? It's not actually a Flash game.
Oh, so this is a downloadable EXE file, I guess.
And actually does some pretty nice graphical stuff despite being in 2D.
Great. Well, another good shout out to the indie game movement. Let's go ahead and move on to your next game.
Our last two. The last two are both indie games as well.
Great.
The best game about architectural goo and social commentary goes to World of Goo.
World of Goo.
This is a really fun little game. I know it's out on WiiWare. It's also out on PC. Maybe Xbox Live Arcade has it. I'm not sure.
Not yet, unfortunately.
It'll probably be around there eventually. Really cool little game. Nice, satisfying mechanic. A little bit frustrating at times, but a blast to play, in my opinion.
Again, since this is an indie game, although I think a bit more well-known indie game, I think this has actually gotten a lot of good notoriety. Why don't you go ahead and explain how the game is played or what the game is about?
Okay, yeah. People may have played physics-based games before. This is entirely physics-based. You use these little blobs and you stretch them from one to the next to create lattice works of these little blobs of goo to create structures that then solve problems in the game world. And the game gives you different types of goo balls that can do different things and builds on previous knowledge very, very nicely. I mean, the progression of complexity and difficulty in the game is superb.
Right.
Also, the feel of it, it's a little imprecise. I think that's good because it helps get the feel of the material that you're working with, which is this sticky goo stuff that both is bouncy and yet has some tensile strength and definitely gets the idea of the material across very well.
Scott or Steven, did any of you guys play this game?
Yeah, I've played this game pretty extensively. I think I'm completed probably the first, I don't know, 2.5 hours of the game, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The first couple of sections, and I really enjoyed it. As an engineer, it's a lot of fun to sort of optimize and really, really try and use the fewest possible goo balls and try and optimize your structures.
Right.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
Yeah, I found it to be a lot of fun. And while I didn't find the structural element nearly as difficult as I think some other people did.
Sure.
You know, I found some of the later challenges where you're, you know, having like balloons and you have a lot more different physics concepts you're working with.
Right.
I found that part to be challenging and sometimes frustrating and sometimes really cool.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it does add some really fun concepts and items like balloons and things in there to really differentiate from other types of similar gameplay concepts.
So this is something I probably should have asked for the other games, but this being an indie game and sort of, you know, indie casual game, do you feel this game has broad appeal or maybe just like core geeky gamer appeal?
That's a good question. I actually think this game has quite broad appeal because of the simple mechanic in it. It's not something that takes a vast amount of time to learn. And I find that to be the greatest sort of equalizer in terms of gaming. It's not how believable your story is. It's not how much like a movie you try to be. And it's not even your difficulty level.
Right.
Some of the early NES games were very, very difficult. But that didn't stop them from selling extremely well and from many, many people playing them.
Sure.
So I think the amount that they do with simple concepts helps it to have that appeal.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, this is a game that I've wanted to play, but I really haven't gotten around to it. It's something that I've heard is really fun to play on the Wii, and I need a reason to pull the Wii out of mothballs, because I really haven't been giving it a lot of love recently. So, a game to check out, definitely a good recommend. Let's go ahead and move on to your last game.
Yeah, overall, I would definitely say that WiiWare is a reason to pick up the Wii again if you've put it aside for a while.
Sure, definitely.
Final game in my top 10 is the best game that I bought this year. I was going to leave it at that, but I had to qualify it with one more thing that was marred by a terrible user experience because of features mandated by Microsoft.
I think I know where this is going.
Castle Crashers. So much fun. Just a blast to play. So much fun, in fact, that we improvised controllers when we didn't have enough and used everything from Rock Band guitars to drum sets to play this.
Including making characters that were optimized based on the fact that magic was unavailable on drums.
Yes. Oh, man. That was... But it was still fun, wasn't it, Steven?
Oh, it was a blast. It ended up being the most powerful character.
Wow. That's a little nuts.
Yeah. So I definitely have to give that one a shout-out. But the way they bring together the multiplayer aspect of it gets marred a little bit by the Xbox experience. For a couple of reasons. First, when you get weapons, not everyone can freely wield them. You have to go back into a level, drop the weapon,
make
sure everyone else picks it up, and then go back to the hut, and then everyone can use it.
Right.
And there's nothing to tell you when you're in your little weapon hut who owns what blade, except go up to it and try and see if you can take it.
Right.
I thought that was... Because it's so simple to go and switch it out, it just simply added a tedious aspect to getting these weapons as opposed to, you know, just giving them to everybody if they're logged into the game when it's picked up.
Yep.
The other thing that was a little frustrating was having to quit and restart the game if you wanted to add or remove players.
Yeah.
One of the most fantastic multiplayer cooperative experiences of this sort was had back on the SNES, where all you had to do was plug in another controller and press start to grab a new player in Secret of Mana.
Right.
And then you can press start again and leave, and that character keeps going on AI-controlled, and everyone else can have their fun, so you can get up and go to the bathroom and not have to interrupt the game.
Sure.
So I felt that was lacking in Castle Crashers. Would have taken what was a very, very good game and made it into an excellent game if they didn't have to jump through some of the clunky interface hoops of the mandated features of...
I think a lot of games have that problem with this, just the signing in process and having to have an account to play. I think there's a bit of overhead you have to play to do stuff on the Xbox 360, though ultimately a good thing, because I think the Xbox 360 overall is a great platform.
Yeah, ultimately I like what they do with those things, so I can't complain, except that I feel like the implementation is botched most of the time.
Sure.
Which is a little bit of a disappointment. This happens with Rock Band as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
let's say I want to play drums now, but I want my character and my profile to play drums.
Right. You have to sign out.
The way to do that is turn off the console and restart the entire game from step one.
Yeah. Castle Crashers, it was actually one of my favorite games this year. It's made by Behemoth, the same people who did Alien Hominid, and what's cool about it is they have this really cool style where it looks like it's kind of a flash game style, and it looks like a cartoon. All the actions your character does are very animated, very like cartoon animated. So it's not just a simple like, you know, I swing my sword and, you know, the guy's arm goes forward and his sword goes forward. It's like I swing the sword and there's this cool cartoon animated style where he swings it and there's this little whoosh thing, and It's very, very, very neat. And the same thing with, like killing enemies, too, is very, very well animated. And you really feel like you're playing this sort of live-action cartoon, which is which is incredibly fun. And they also have a wonderful sense of humor, too. All their games have this really quirky, sometimes macabre, but usually just crazy sense of humor. Like, one of the bosses you play in this is a giant head of corn in this cornfield. And it's just, it's incredibly fun to play that. And, I really love this game. I like the style that Behemoth does. I think they're a really great sort of small developer. And though I think this is a game that has to be played with other people, like at least three people to really be enjoyed. And I think to some degree that's a bit of a fault of the game. But I'm perfectly happy to play a game, you know, just like Rock Band that works well when you're playing together.
Yeah, I would say it's only a fault of the game if you are trying to play it alone. But if you're doing that, I might even say that's your fault.
Yeah, maybe you should get some friends. Right.
Yeah.
But sure.
But it's a fantastic multiplayer experience. One thing that I like about it too is the variety.
Right.
It just gives you, for what's typically a very monotonous style of game, the brawler.
The side-scrolling brawler, right.
Yeah. It very handily just provides enough variation to keep things interesting. From the escape the monster sequence, riding the little deer, that part is hilarious.
Yeah.
to the...
A bit gross, but hilarious.
Yeah. Well, you can tell that the game originated, or that the people who made the game got their start on Newgrounds.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
Right.
But also later on when you go to the desert and you get the shovels and you start, you know, digging up treasure, stuff like that, lots of fun.
Yeah.
So that concludes my top 10 of 08 and a little bit of 07.
And actually, before we conclude, I'm going to go ahead and say, Steven or Scott, do you guys want to add something to this, as I'm sure you guys were probably the other people playing this game?
Well, I enjoyed the game. I thought the team playing aspect of it was the most fun. The fact that there was sort of a lot of teamwork that you had to do depending on which character was played by who and who actually was good at, you know, not dying.
Right.
and rezzing, and it's a constant battle, and it's a lot of fun, even for casual gamers who are just starting.
No, I agree that one of the cool parts about this game is when one of the players dies, another team player can come by and perform CPR on them, basically, and it's a really clever way of sort of not introducing the concept of having lives, and if, you know, one person is really bad, they bring down the rest of the team. And even like in some of the really hard boss battles, we were playing that thing where it's like, okay, you go over here and fight the guy while I'll be in charge of, you know, rezzing people over here as they die. And it adds a fun team play element into it.
Yeah. Well, that's really all I had.
Scott, anything to add on to this?
I'm afraid that I was the Castle Crashers crasher in the sense that I was the guy throwing everyone off the console so I could play Fallout 3.
Ah, I see. Yeah. but yeah, a great game. I look forward to anything that Behemoth does. If you enjoyed this, if you go through this game and play this, I would also recommend checking out Alien Hominid, which is also available on the Xbox Live Arcade. Also, a very fun game, similar in ways of the kind of, it's kind of side-scrolling shooter, like Sunset Riders or some of these old arcade games.
Sort of like Contra.
Or kind of like Contra, yeah.
Yeah, owes a lot to that. Especially the dying without warning.
Right.
Lots and lots.
Right. But yeah, well, I think we're actually going to cut it there because I don't think we can move on to the next one. And again, I think we've already passed everyone's tolerance point for this particular podcast. We'll come back in the next episode and do my top 10 games and after that we'll get into some of our dubious honors, which are our worst and most disappointing movies and games. But thanks again for tuning in to Weekly Monotony. We hope you guys are enjoying the podcast so far. Definitely send in some comments if you'd like to let us know how we're doing, how we can improve things, maybe speed things up a little bit. And as always, be sure to check out dailymonotony.com for all your game reviews, movie reviews, and TV reviews as they trickle in at their somewhat erratic rate. But thanks for listening, guys.
Yep, thanks.
This is Starfleet out.